This week on Retronauts, heroes, foxy bounty hunters, and literal foxes. Hello, and welcome to Retronauts, where we talk about old video game comics that smell of dust and ink. It's the good stuff. I'm your host for this week, Nadia Oxford. With me is my chronic problem, Anthony John Agnello. Say hi.
I like that I am a persistent condition in your podcasting world, Nadia. Like, it's like when you've had something like removed via electrolysis and yet it keeps coming back.
I have melasma and I have you.
This is the role I can fulfill.
And I have a very welcome, I was going to say newcomer, Peter Smith. Have you been on Retronauts before? You said we're doing a Mega Man thing together, and I totally blanked out. I'm sorry.
I have never been on Retronauts before, as far as I can remember.
Hi.
It's great to see you both and hear both of your voices.
It is. Yeah. We used to all work together. Like, you all know about my sordid history with Anthony John Agnello, but Peter Smith, yeah, all 61 frames per second. God bless.
Yeah, that our old hippie dream of video game journalism.
Our commune.
I do like that. Like, every now and again, we could be like, yeah, we used to run a video game journalism ashram. That's what we used to do. Everybody pooled their sorghum harvest and then wrote about the Mother 3 localization in the long, long ago.
We sure did. A really good time. Peter, do you want to tell us anything else about yourself, like what you're doing these days?
Sure. I am now, after years as a hobbyist, I'm now a full-time developer for Studio MDHR, the makers of Cuphead.
Cuphead. So are you in the Toronto area?
No, it's all remote.
Oh, okay.
I'm in New York.
I was going to say close enough, but I once actually went to New York and I was behind a woman on the train who said, yeah, I go to Toronto to relax. So that's how you know you're from New York. So if you enjoy this podcast, please keep in mind there's a lot more on Retronauts.com. Please do support our Patreon if you want to keep hearing us talk about these, all this cool video game shit and Toronto shutouts and, other stuff that's favored by people with sore bones. So I think our URL is patreon.com/Retronauts. Yes, that's it. I have to remember so many Patreon links these days. So today's topic, we're talking about video game comics this week, specifically three serialized Nintendo Power comics, which are The Legend of Zelda, Star Fox, and Metroid. There are others, and we'll certainly dip into those, especially at Peter's request, but, three is a good number. Triforce. You can't open the door. Triforce.
I brought props for the other ones, too, Nadia.
My next question was, do you gentlemen have history with these comics, and please tell me about it?
So I think all the people listening to this I feel like Retronauts has a crop of people that do consider things like the Xbox 360 a retro console at this point. I know that that's part of the contingent listening.
Yeah.
All three of us were the Nintendo Power generation. We were there for the transition from Nintendo Fun Club to bonafide Nintendo Power. And rather than internalizing the idea that we were just like being handed a book of commercials every single month, these were religious texts.
Yes,
these were holy tomes being handed down, and we're like, holy shit, I can learn about Zelda and have a chance to be in the Wayne's World video game. I'm gonna enter this contest twice. When they started doing the comics, and I know that Nestor is not on the table,
right,
it felt like one more facet of this like hidden history and definitive statement about these objects that you were only glimpsing a part of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember so vividly when the Zelda comic in particular started, and I had just turned 10 years old, I assumed, oh, surely this is like all comics and this is just the Link to the Past version. So right, there are all these other Zelda comics that I've just never seen or had access to. And I'm just getting this slightest glimpse into a bigger world. And I say it as like a joke, but I did treat that Zelda comic with almost religious fervor. It was just every single panel was so evocative and big. It's so big. And rereading it ahead of this show, I know we'll get to it, but yeah. I was shocked at how it still feels that way in a lot of ways.
Zelda in particular, and we'll certainly get to this, was by a legendary Japanese artist, Shotaro Ishinomori. Is that the name?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you've ever liked an episode of Power Rangers, this is the man you thank. He is like the father of Sentai, just incredible manga artist. It's actually stunning that Nintendo got him to do a comic. But what particularly grabbed you about the Nintendo Zelda comic? Was it just how...
every single piece of it. And I actually wrote about this for the AV Club a few years ago, in the before times when the AV Club wasn't just like a zombie sort of trudging across the internet.
Yeah, I love the AV Club. I miss it so much.
I long for those days. But I loved the way that it truly, in the exact same way that the first three Zelda games do, it just implies this whole world surrounding everything else you see. Like, it truly feels like this is a fun... You see maybe total... Do you see 10 full characters across this comic? Like, are there 10 individuals? Maybe a dozen?
Mm-hmm.
And yet every single one of them feels like they live in a place where they have a daily life. They do things. They go about their business. And that's always counterpointed with an image like Link wearing, you know, mythical wings and sailing over sand dunes that go for as far as the eye can see. That sort of counterpoint of a lived-in world with just something that dwarfs the individual just was so captivating and still is so captivating. And like Star Fox, it's so funny. Star Fox was the only other of these comics that we're talking about today that I read at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I missed the Metroid ones entirely. And like some of the other things that like were on the periphery of the Nintendo Power Comics world, like F-Zero, they always captured that same vibe. They always captured the vibe of there's a world beyond what you're experiencing. And I wasn't old enough to have internalized the idea of like fated hero whose father figure has vanished or disappeared. Mm-hmm. It was a trope, you know, like Fox McCloud all of a sudden encountering his dad again. I was like, holy fucking shit, this is dad. Dude, he lived. We wear sunglasses. That's how you know he's good at it. Like, felt enormous.
Everyone's trope is like that sees it their first. You know what I mean? Everyone has their first trope. So that's absolutely certain. What about you, Peter?
Same as you guys. I read all of these as they came out, which meant I was, I'm sure, exactly the right age to read them. And having revisited all of them, or what I think of as the four big ones, mm-hmm. Mario, Zelda, Star Fox, and Metroid, this weekend to get ready to talk to you guys, I have opinions about each of them, but I was there. I'll corroborate what Anthony says, that they illuminated a larger world of these games, which maybe was just sort of resonating with a frequency that we were already detecting when playing them. But not to spoil anything, but you know, I felt a little trepidation about revisiting the Zelda comic in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I bought myself a copy of it, you know, 10 years ago, but I hadn't really dared to crack it open because I was like, it had meant so much to me when I was 10. And I was like, how good could it really be? You know, when you revisit something that you loved when you were 10 after 30 years, it's a bit of a coin flip. And boy, I am really excited about it. I'm really excited to talk about it. I was really taken with it. I think it's just an amazing piece of work. And, you know, I also have thoughts about the other ones.
Speaking of the other one, so Am I the only one who's like read or remembers Metroid? Did you say you had read it, Peter?
I reread it this weekend, and I read it at the time.
Okay. Yeah. I figure that might be a good one to start with because it's such a, well, it's the shortest one. And we have talked about how these comics expanded the world. I think maybe Metroid was failed a little bit on that one because I feel like it was rushed or stopped suddenly. And I couldn't find any information about why it felt like that, why it was truncated. But either way, everything kind of ended on a just bang, so to speak. But to kind of set the stage about the Metroid comic that was written and illustrated by Benamaro Ito, who also did the Star Fox comic, which we'll talk about. He's an illustrator, he's a musician, and he works for HAL. And apparently he wears leopard print a lot, which is something I like very much about him already. And I included a picture in the notes. I don't know if you gentlemen saw it, but he's holding like it's a two-necked ukulele. I don't know what the hell I'm looking at, but I just know this man is wearing leopard print and is extremely tickled about it. So I have to say his artwork is superb. Like looking back on it, I see so much detail and so much love. Weird color choices sometimes. I still don't know what's up with Samus's purple hair, especially since they made Samus specifically, according to Nintendo Power's editor-in-chief at the time, Gail Tilden. They weren't sure how to make Samus look because we had never really seen her. We saw her pixely face. But if you want an idea of what happens when an artist goes straight from pixels to illustrating, you go back and look at Mega Man on Captain N. And that's exactly why Mega Man looks like a squat 2-foot smoker who's green, because literally the guy's collar was apparently going out. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's actually the funniest thing I've ever heard. So not the problem with these comics. They're all illustrated gorgeously. Again, Samus has the purple hair. I don't know why, but I also wrote in the comments that Samus was supposed to be a combination between Ripley and Princess Leia. And that's actually very suitable because Samus is, quote unquote, 6'20" fucking killing for fun. So you'll find a lot of fans of this depiction of Samus, the big Amazon muscly snoo Samus. I have to agree. I'm not hating on Zero Suit Samus, but I remember reading these comics and being like, holy shit, a woman can be huge and muscly, because I think that's actually really cool. And it made sense to me. She's kind of living in this power suit. She has three biological fathers and two of them are birds. So she's just like, she's different. And she actually looked really strong and cool through most of the comic. What did you guys think of the comic besides including the shut door ending there?
Nadia, to continue your referential train of thought, I do like that this Samus is like, I heard that Samus has like 30 goddamn dicks.
Like, take off her shoes. She's got like 40 dicks and dicks growing out of her dicks.
Like, I do love that this is just Samus murdering everything. And I love the airbrushed, like, heavy metal van. This and the Star Fox comic have a video games meets a Dio album cover vibe that I appreciate a lot. And it is in no way, shape, or form, like, sort of soulful in the way that the Zelda comic inexplicably is. I didn't read this until the early aughts. I didn't read this until I was out of college and wasting way too much time on the internet and finding all the weird corners, and read it back to back with the manga that Sakamoto himself had worked on. And so I thought that they went together. Like, I interpreted this as like, this is issue one and then this is issue two. And I was like, wow, there's really hard cut from just like Beefcake Samus murdering slime balls to her parents dying. I was like, that's an odd hard cut.
But
it's cool.
This is actually like this Metroid comic set some of Samus's canon. Very quickly, very like generally, like, yes, she was an orphan on planet KLL5, something like that. It was a mining colony, got blown up by the space pirates. She was found and raised by the Chozo. She received their DNA and she got their training, and then she became a sooty girl. And yes, I know exactly the comic, sorry, the manga you're referring to, Anthony. Oh, don't I sound like a weeb? The manga. Sorry, the comic. I know the exact one you're referring to. And yeah, that was certainly carried on that canon and kind of deepened it and gave us more lore. And I always found that very interesting. And again, I tried to look up information like the West kind of meeting the East here. It feels like they're building off each other in a relationship that was very rare at the time. And I find that very fascinating. And it's a shame I can't find a little bit more about it. But yes, the comic, actually the manga, again, that you're talking about, Anthony, I also find extremely interesting, going off topic for half a second, because it has the breakdown of Samus. She has a terrible PTSD episode because she sees Ripley and she's like, holy shit, this is the thing that killed my parents. And they kind of tried to mimic that in Other M, and it was just like disastrously bad. So to this day, I understand what they were going for with Other M, but dear God in heaven, they did not nail it. Peter, do you have any?
I was a 28-year-old man. Oh, sorry.
No, like, tell me about being a 28-year-old man.
28-year-old man playing Other M, and I was actually-ing people and be like, this is in line with the appropriate depiction of the character at the time in her life. And much to Pete's chagrin at the time, being like, no talking in Metroid. That was the
no talking in Metroid.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a great segue, because I think that points to one of the problems with this comic innately. And so I had no particular feelings about this as I revisited it. I remembered vaguely as a kid not being as taken with it, but not hating it or anything. And revisiting, I have to say, it's spectacular in some ways. I mean, you guys are right. The art is really pretty special in its own way. And there are a few two-page spreads that are just really flamboyant.
Really nice.
And his use of color, like you said, sort of borders on the psychedelic. It's extremely saturated and vivid. And I also think that the comic starts very strong. And I think the characterization of Samus is really good, significantly better than a lot of the more canonical versions. And I think obviously going to Ripley is a good place to start.
Yeah.
It's a good place to start anything that you're doing, making lunch or. but I did think, in contrast to the other comics that we're going to talk about, which we all agreed sort of gave you a sense of a more expansive world, if anything, I feel like this comic condensed or compressed or diminished the world of Metroid by the end of it and made me think, this is kind of, you know, like a bunch of cheesy crap.
Ripley takes off. He just turns tail and runs. There's no fight. That's the best part. Also, sorry, minor interjection with some Samus trivia that came up in my head. She was initially based on Kim Basinger, according to Sakamoto. So anytime I see... Last Dance with Mary Jane. She's in that as the dead body. So I think I inextricably have like Samus and a dead body linked in my head, surrounded by candles. Yeah. And you know what? 93 was the best year for music videos. There's a Retronauts episode for you. Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, but no, Nadia, that's what happens at the end. Tom Petty picks up Kim Basinger out of that water and then lays her in the power suit. That's the extended.
Oh my god,
that's what happens after if you this do the power guy. Bomb sacrifice thing.
AMVs by Sakamoto. Do not steal.
You know, on the subject of quiet, silent Metroid is the best Metroid, I think that a lot of the experience of playing Metroid and a lot of the character of Metroid is about solitude. And that doesn't necessarily translate to storytelling in a different medium or a different format where it's hard to pull off like a silent movie feel and a solitary thing. And you want characters to have things to bounce off of. And you know, I think we're going to touch on this. The characters that Samus bounces off of
in
this comic suck really bad and just seem so absurd and completely take you out of this contemplative space.
Especially what's his name? Houston. I don't know if you remember, you guys, in Brinstar in Super Metroid, you see like kind of a dead body being eaten by space bugs. I still say that's Houston.
Yeah, there's another bounty hunter. Just to contextualize this, there's another bounty hunter named Houston, which is fucking hilarious to me. As if I think about the captain from Alien is named Dallas.
Oh, shit.
They're like, here's my buddy, Commander El Paso.
It's like the joke in Star Fox. I'm going to jump ahead very quickly where here's a letter from Sergeant, from General Pepper. I thought he was a sergeant.
He was a sergeant. That works a lot better in Star Fox.
It does.
They're kind of doing that kind of thing in Metroid. And that character sucks. There's like a lot of time given to two galactic bureaucrats who are super cartoony. That part sucks.
It defies the purpose of what I'm not saying Samus has to be in solitude. Absolutely not. Like, I actually think Metroid Dread, when she speaks Chozo to her mentor, like, that's really fucking cool. I like that kind of solitude. Like, I think Dread really nailed it, but that's a very, very hard thing to get, as you say, on a comic. But dear God, just the kid appeal characters, like, Samus doesn't need to look cooler than she is. She doesn't have to bounce off idiots like Houston. So, don't do it.
Yeah, I was a kid at the time and it didn't appeal to me then. So
Dread is the platonic ideal of Metroid and talking, because this comic acknowledges the failure that later games recognize, where it's like, well, she should probably have other people to interact with at some point, and it's always death, whether it's like the shitty X-Men in Prime 3 or the chatty bird bug moth guy in Prime 2, or all of the Federation chuds in
The Federation
Other M.
Can't do anything good for you.
I like Robot Adam.
Robot Adam is pretty cool.
Perfect. Excellent, spooky in both fusion.
I have another piece of obscure ass Metroid trivia that this might be a great solution. I would write a fanfic about this. Okay. It's canon and yet it is not. But there was a Nintendo made guidebook to Metroid in Japan, Super Metroid. Yeah, Anthony's giving me the thumbs up here. He knows what I'm talking about. Where for some reason they had a famous Japanese psychic give a reading, quote unquote, to Samus. And the shit she came up with, holy freaking moly, literally saying that Samus will meet a lover, have a child, and have to leave them both. And I'm like, holy shit, that's incredible. Why is this not in the game? I love this. Give me a pen and paper. I gotta fix this shit.
But then her lover would be Houston.
No. Although it does infer that her lover would be kind of a stupid idiot that she falls for, because apparently she has a weakness for stupid idiots.
Are you familiar with this, that like the official Super Metroid guide, Pete, that has like the fortune teller's reading of Samus's life? Because it's not just that, it's also the contemporary, much better comic. There's no Houston. There are like New Yorker style panel comics throughout the guidebook. And the best of them is like Samus and then the baby Metroid from the end of Metroid 2. And I think the caption is something like failed single mother. And I'm like, where's the Nintendo power? Couple this art vision with that text.
No, it wasn't now failed single mother. It was something like, you know, noble single mother.
It's noble single mother?
It was something very, very nice. I think unmarried, something like that did kind of damn her in a slight way, but made her so much cooler. But yeah, I remember the comics you're talking about, too.
It's another thing we should touch on is that, astonishingly, this comic botches the ending of Super Metroid, which is, when you're trying to adapt a game that doesn't have a lot of story into a story, you would think that you would use the material you were given at minimum. Right. And I actually have always had a lot of misgivings about the ending of Super Metroid, and I think it's a little corny, and I think that, you know, if one of the Alien movies ended with Ripley raising a baby alien and the baby alien thinks that it's her mother, if she's its mother, that sort of diminishes the alienness of the aliens. And I think, you know, the threat of the Metroids, if they're like cute little mammals, is sort of made trivial. And it's like a very almost like provincial way to frame the story. However, at this point, and even when it came out, it was a big swing, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't use this lightly, an iconic storytelling beat.
Right.
And in the comic, I hope I'm not spoiling anything, but Samus is having a big fight with Mother Brain, and two of these background characters just kill the baby Metroid while it's flying around.
That's right. They shoot it.
So there's none of the like heroic self-sacrifice, you know, save mother thing. It's just like, it, like, wrong place, wrong time, total happenstance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know who let that get past.
Again, it just feels like a door was slammed on the whole thing. And it's really a shame because I feel like there was supposed to be a relationship with Houston, which was immediately written off because at first, like, there's a point where Samus screws up and she has to be taken back to her home planet to be repaired. And that's where you find out her past. And first, Old Bird says, like, oh, she was distracted thinking about you. And then he's like, oh, no, wait, I'm wrong. So I think that was like where that was ended. And then again, I mentioned Ridley turning tail and running instead of fighting. So, yeah, it's a good comic. I certainly recommend it for anyone who really wants to see what the start of Samus was. But then you go ahead and read the manga to kind of get more of that. I definitely recommend that. And I do especially recommend looking up the Nintendo guidebook, weird stuff about the bastard child. That's some great shit right there.
So good.
Are you gents so ready to move on to Star Fox?
Ben Amaro Ito, I find it both amazing and deeply disturbing the anatomical fox mouths that he drew throughout this comic. These are some some real maws happening.
It's just like anthropomorphize just a little more, please. Just a little.
As a Jew, I'm allowed to laugh at Star Fox Mouse. That's my ticket. That's my right. But this isn't that. This is it's a pretty grim comic at times, especially with the last, like, there's three arcs, and the last arc, I feel like he stopped giving a shit and in the best way possible. But we start off pretty normally. This, again, is another canon establishing story, more or less. We learn about Fox McCloud. He was a bandit who became an R-Wing fighter because, you know, he's the bandit. So he's chaotic good. He knows how to do this shit. It was a big comic, 132 pages in total, published from February 1993 to December 1993. Yes, this game about shooty triangles in space had a riveting story behind it. I don't know if I had the story before or after or alongside the comic, but there is some stuff that I found in the game that was kind of parallel to the comic. Like when I got to the black hole in the game, General Pepper was like, oh, this is where your father died, Fox. And so when I was a kid, I used to go crazy looking for like every pixel of this area to find Fox's father. And I didn't realize I had to wait until Star Fox 64 to get any sort of closure, kind of like how I had to wait until Chrono Cross to get any closure about Shala and the Ocean Palace. Thank you, Square Enix, for making my life hell.
Yeah, but wasn't that worth the wait, Nadia? You know, she just turned into a blonde and lived in a crab until the end of time. It all worked out.
The remix there of Shala's theme is fucking incredible. Like, it was worth it for that. I will say that. But
Star Fox, actual Star Fox thing, I appreciated that this actually... So, like, Zelda and Metroid, like, Zelda was defined enough as a game that the comic felt super strange. And we'll get to that. And like that only enhanced the sort of like almost mystic element of reading it. Mm-hmm. But like Star Fox was so unfleshed out as a game. Like there's even less sort of explicit text in the actual thing than in Metroid. Right. Metroid always gives you very like, here's explicit framework. Here are very clear dramatic beats. Star Fox is just very loose. And you have like a pretty good idea of character, but not overall plot. And this felt like it fit all of the pieces together in a more meaningful way, which definitely softened the blow of the weird mouths. One little backstory piece here was this was where my Nintendo Power subscription ended as a kid. And like, I was like, I don't need this to be renewed. I'm okay moving on to...
I'm a Sega kid now.
I wasn't a Sega kid, and I was ride or die Nintendo, especially in 1993.
A good year.
But it was just like I don't know what it was. Like by the end of the year, like when Link's Awakening was coming out, I was almost like, I want to discover these, like I want to experience these things without context at that
right.
point.
Right. Right.
Like, I don't need to know, I don't need previews about Mortal Monday. I'm going to be there on Mortal yeah. Monday, Nintendo Power. But I wanted to know how the Star Fox comic ended. And it turned out getting issues of Nintendo Power at the newsstand was a pain in the fucking ass.
Absolutely.
So those, I think I missed like a few parts and like had the final one, but was missing the second and third to last ones. And it was like, it made these feel even more dramatic because you missed issues and you like, you couldn't go anywhere to find them at all.
I didn't have a subscription, but I did have a friend who kind of gave me all the old issues of Nintendo Power. And I remember reading the Star Fox comic, and my collection that she gave me kind of ended where right before they went into the black hole. And I was like, oh damn, that's a crazy place to end, man. And as you say, some of these comics really expand the story and the setting of these games, which are very small compared to what we see these days. And for Star Fox, that's especially fascinating because this is literally a game about triangles. Here's Corneria, is a bunch of boxes on the floor. Enjoy. So what I really appreciated about the art is how, like, for example, Titania has that big bridge that you fly under. Like they captured that in the comics. Or how the planet of weird-ass dinosaurs and birds, which was actually designed really, really well for what they had to work with, how that kind of fleshed out as a blood and flesh place, so to speak. And also Peppy was psychic for some reason. I don't know. I don't know if that was ever retained as canon.
All rabbits are psychic.
Watership Down could have ended a lot less bloody if they were. There's a dog, better run. No, let's run towards it. That's the best idea. I really liked how they depicted what happened to Fox's father, which is, he got sucked into the black hole and he became part of a dimension of interdimensional beings that flew around on a whale. And a whale is canonical to this game. Like there are space like fish in Sector Y. It's a really nice area, actually, like another great design for a level. But I just love that he lived inside of a whale and was dispensing canisters of gas because his son was like stuck in space like an idiot. And again, that's canonical to the game. The whale will give you like a lot of cool power-ups and stuff. So Ito really took this world and really added some great imagination to it. And also somebody took some LSD at the end there because space whale.
it trips out a little. I think I agree with you guys. I would say of his two, of Metroid and this one, this is substantially more successful.
It is.
And it really suits the tone, or what I guess I would say is that the implicit tone of the game, the tone that they found for the comic is a much better fit than the tone that they found for the Metroid comic.
It feels like he had more space to work, like all the space he wanted.
Definitely more space to work. More, you know, there's like some dumb jokes in it and they work.
They do. There were some funny puns.
It's got kind of like a zany, playful feel. And it actually really suits the roguishness of the setup. Like I think it's great to have the Star Fox team be sort of Robin Hood characters or bandits, and that tone, that playfulness of tone goes well with sort of the scrappiness
that actually carries into Star Fox 64. And then I think about it, because you get General Pepper a receipt for your work, and he says like, this is one steep bill but it's worth it, and stamps it. Now, that is dependent on what kind of a score you rack up. If you have like a minor score, he won't say anything. If it's like kind of a medium score, he'll say, oh, this is steep, but it was worth it. I once got really high and you just hear him say, what? lost it. So I like, as you say, they have that roguishness that they did eventually adapt for the games. I also love how There's a whole chapter about them getting to Corneria from Papatoon, where they're from, Papatoon, whatever. And they weren't sent tickets. I love that. Like, Pepper didn't send them tickets. They had to stow away. And yeah. The thing I remember vividly, this is one of my favorite scenes, is when they save Farrah Phoenix, who's the love interest for Fox. And the father of Pharaoh's like, you can have anything you want in the world for saving my daughter. And they say, Fox says, oh, how about first class tickets? And Falco says to him, you idiot, you could have asked for a moon. And Star Fox says, oh, moon's not as comfy. So I don't know. He's right. I couldn't argue that.
Nadia, do you know, when you were researching this, there's only one Star Fox game that has a ridiculous amount of lore in it, and it's Star Fox Command.
Oh, I know all about Command.
Pete, I don't know if you ever played any of Star Fox Command, but it's one of, I don't know why the legacy of Star Fox is, why don't we make a very simple game that is an absolute miserable chore to physically play?
Right. What the F?
But it's all like, oh yeah, Fox and Slippy are estranged, and Slippy's like working at a gas station now, but Crystal doesn't call him anymore. It's like a whole fucking thing. Do you know if any of the story beats and elements from the comic in this carried over into that? Is there like a melange of like this and Star Fox Adventures?
I can't say I'm a scholar, but I have kind of like dabbled in which, by the way, Star Fox Command, I remember first hearing about it. I was on Paris's forums at the time, and someone was kind of posting screens and dunking on it. And someone else who's in this thread said, oh my God, I thought this was like a fan game with someone's deviant art depictions of Star Fox. I said, you're not wrong. It's the lore is a lot. There's things, they do add a lot of characters that you just don't see at all in the comics. There's that panther who steals Crystal from Fox, and it's just like, holy shit, I'd go with the panther. Sorry, Fox, you're kind of a loser. There was also, and this is very relevant in the space of new information, there was an ending where Fox and Falco would join the Grand Prix, the F-Zero. And we just had that, you know, whole thing come out about how this rumored game was supposed to be a Star Fox and F-Zero crossover, and it never existed. Someone just made shit up, which is disappointing because that's a good crossover, I have to admit.
Oh, yeah. The whole arc of like making Metroid and Star Fox and F-Zero all canonical with each other, like, I buy that. That works.
Me too.
In a, you know, not messy way at all.
This is Nintendo's Dark Tower. Star Fox.
And that's and movie. That everybody knows that once you ascend the tower, you just find Tingle waiting at all times on the top floor, waiting to reset reality. So we all have to do it again. I would have
blamed Kirby, because he's got to be the top of some kind of like horror trifecta or something. But I also wanted to mention that Andross in this game, first of all, raised by android pigs, which is, there's actually a really cute panel of him as this little tiny baby clinging to his android parents. I thought that was very cute. Apparently, here's the thing about this comic. First, you have your first arc, blah, 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 Airwings take on big transformer face, Andross, whatever's going on with that face. He looks like the mascot from PlayStation, that face. Boom, done, we're over, yay, everyone go home. Second arc was more like, okay, Andross was found and cloned. He was found and, well, basically he lived. And blah, 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 have to deal with that. He's commanding these animals, like he's commanding the fish in Sector 9. He's commanding the Monarch Jar-Jar, which is the dragon, in Fortuna. Things go wrong. He gets stepped on by the dragon. I'm serious. And he dies. End of arc 2. Arc 3 is where I think Ito said, oh, you want me to make another one, huh? Oh, okay. Basically, Andross is cloned by his android pig friend named Herbert. And he thinks, oh, two of me, we'll get Star Fox now. And it all goes to shit because the clones turn on each other, because one clone sees a picture of, no, sorry, he sees Fox's girlfriend, Vixie, and thinks it's Fox's mother, who apparently he loves so much that he killed Fox's father with a car bomb, except the car bomb killed Vixie instead. So there is literally a panel where he says, let me see. I was young, in love, and I had a spare bomb. And this is him screaming out, by the way. This is all being broadcast to the world in Star Fox. And like, you know, Clone 2 is like, what are you doing, you dumb fool? And they struggle. But Star Fox just loses his mind, goes like Super Saiyan with rage, like his eyes become these pupilless horrors, and he's like blasting Andros. I'm like, blah, poop, I hate you, Andros. I'll never forgive you. And then he just kind of chases Andros into the black hole and is like, oh, what about Andros? Oh, my father will deal with him on the space whale. So that kind of ended. It did end a little abruptly, but not as abruptly as Metroid. But holy shit, car bomb. Vixie got into the car. Like, there's a whole thing about Pharaoh looking like Fox's mother and Fox saying, if my father saw you right now, he loses his mind. It's a little awkward to read in this day and age.
The picture you included of the man who authored this, everything checks out now. Like, this guy with a 12-string leopard print guitar would definitely write this story with a straight face.
And this was Nintendo in the conviction. Age of, hey, Final Fantasy VI, you can't say die, even though your game is about a literal apocalypse. And there's a car bomb in the Star Fox universe, I guess. Okay. Your thing, Nintendo. Oh, and it's in your official magazine. Oh, all right. I like it. Okay. Whatever you say, man.
It is a hilarious characterization. I definitely lost it at that part. Although I have to say, Andros's backstory is that he hates the military because a military test killed his foster parents.
That's right. Yeah, Corneria destroyed his parents in a war.
Corneria killed his parents, which that made me be like, that was like some Killmonger was right shit. I mean, he's right to be mad.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He probably shouldn't have resorted to a car bomb, but he has the right to be mad. And like I was saying, that panel of him is like little naked monkey thing clinging to his parents is very, very cute, I have to say. What a weird-ass comic. I think it might be my favorite. I know, you know, maybe Zelda is the popular favorite here, which I guess we should go right on to. No car bombs in Zelda, though, so I don't know how you guys think he can hold up. Just tell me a bit about... Well, you already told me why you like the Zelda comic, so let's just kind of go over it a little bit. We talked about the legendary Japanese artist who made it, Shotaro Ishinmori. If you ever liked a single season of Power Rangers, like I said, or Cyborg 009, I think it's Cyborg 009, how's it pronounced? Kamen Rider, it's kind of a big deal. Yeah, so he just kind of settled down and did a big comic for Nintendo. And this was probably longer than Star Fox. I think it went for a whole year from January 1992 through December 1992. And now what makes this one interesting is, unlike Star Fox, unlike Metroid, it does adhere to some canon, but it really plays with the canon in general. And this apparently was to keep just the reasoning for that is, you know, just to add a more adventurous tone to the story. Anthony, as you said earlier, adding that kind of space to a small world. Like back in the day, we would think of you think of a Zelda map. When I was a kid, I'd think that's not a map. That's a whole field that goes on for miles and miles. But we're just seeing it from the perspective of a video game. So a comic like this really kind of expanded upon that. But I was thinking I was still a little bit too bothered by some of the changes. Like, I don't know why the hang glider pissed me off so much because I wanted the duck. I don't understand some of the changes, and I don't know if it's because they didn't have everything available to them to make the comic. Back then, communication was so much harder than it is now with source materials.
Well, Pete and I were actually talking about this prior to recording. There is, for the prominence of the artist involved, it is shocking how little information there is about this.
Right.
And, you know, Pete, I think you dug up a quote where, you know, in like a French edition, he's just like, yeah, job's a job. I did it what I could. And
I hear that,
you know,
too.
All of that said, I do feel like in 1992, you know, this guy had almost 20 years of history behind him at this point, and he was so prominent. I kind of feel like they were like, hey, here are the basics. I'm sure they gave him some of like the concept art and were like, fucking go nuts. Like, as long as you hit these beats, you can probably do whatever you want. And that was enough of a sell. I do, you know, I didn't question it at the time. Like, I naturally assumed, as I did with all things, that there was a wealth of information about Zelda in general that was simply hidden. Yeah. Like,
Absolutely.
All of life was coming into Amazing Spider-Man at issue 392, right? There is more than you know. Trust that it will be made clear and that maybe you will have access to it, but you can take these things at face value. And part of the fun was filling in the blanks.
Yeah.
And so I loved the idea of it also, like, it did feel of a piece with Zelda 2. You know, it's funny, like, now Zelda 2 is like this black sheep. It's the deep reading that somebody who's played Breath of the Wild 53 times might deign to do on, you know, Nintendo Switch Online. But at the time, it's hard to explain. Like, that game was a big goddamn deal.
Mm-hmm.
And having towns full of weird people that behaved like the librarian in the middle of, you know, this comic, I was like, oh, I'm sure that's really the story. I don't see the librarian when Link goes to get the Book of Moodora, but I'm sure he's there. Like,
yeah.
It makes sense that he is part of all this. And it's funny, the art is so, this is what I've always wanted all manga and anime to look like. Like, I want that 1975 to 1985 vibe.
It's a very vibe. Yeah.
So specific, and like the line it straddles between wholly engrossing drama and completely, if like, you know, frivolous goofballness, it can go between the two in just one panel. I don't know. I like every image in this just feels convincing, for lack of a better
word. I have noticed that there's a certain, like, when Link is being goofy, it's kind of a loose drawing. It's very kind of fun and almost like James Baxter. But when there is a serious moment, and there are a few in this manga, like, it gets very detailed. And I found that very interesting. Like, the intro and the ending are just illustrated extremely well. And I find the like, all respect, but like, all the art in between can kind of go up and down, especially towards the end. I feel like there's a little bit of sloppiness, but no, in general, it's a really interesting retelling. I remember Nintendo Power would kind of pitch its trade with a page from the comic where, like, Aghanim is trying to attack Zelda and Link is like, I will never let you get to her. And I'm like, oh, that's so cool, man. I wish I could have Nintendo Power, but my parents have no money, so I can't. So one thing that did kind of cheese me off, though, a little bit, is that the Dark World is in this comic, and Link becomes, like, the Dark World twists you, so you become, like, a monster or an animal. And I always adored how he became a pink bunny in Link to the Past. Like, that's just... Here's your Link. He's a soft little bunny boy, but you know what? A bunny will fuck you up. If you ever play Fire Emblem, if the Tagwell from Wizard Awakening, 8-foot rabbits, they'll kill you. They're pretty cool. But anyway, so I didn't like the fact that Link kind of turned into a wolf thing in this comic. Like, and I actually wonder to this day if Twilight Princess took that idea, like, because they kind of had a Dark World equivalent, and Link would change form into a wolf. And I know it's supposed to represent courage and all of that, but I kind of wanted him to be a pink bunny in Twilight Princess.
There is a lot of Twilight Princess in this comic, I think, you know, depicting.
Take it back.
I love Twilight Princess.
Pete's nemesis, Twilight
Princess. There's a lot of, you know, what really struck me was there's a lot of Majora's Mask. I mean, there's a couple panels of, like, the creepy skull moon in the dark world.
That's great.
And Link wearing a monster mask, or Link being transformed into a beast, that really evoke that the horror that's in Majora's Mask, and the, you know, you've suffered a terrible fate. And I would say that about this comic in general, that it does have a mix of goofiness and a very dark, eerie, sinister atmosphere at times, which I loved as a kid, and turns out I still love. But I also think, as far as the question of canonicity, I've just never been invested in that. And
Who cares? Yeah,
I did as a child. So
I think people still care now, and I think that's fine. You know, I've seen responses to this comic online that are like, I don't like this version of Link, and you know, whatever. That doesn't bother me. I don't care about fidelity to the games. There's already huge breaches in canon between Zelda 1, Zelda 2, and Zelda 3.
Absolutely.
But the way that this comic takes the game and implies this beautiful, threatening, spooky world, I think is amazing. And the art is just a knockout to me. I think so Ishinomori actually has the Guinness record for the most pages, the most comics pages ever drawn by a single person.
I did not know that. Crazy.
So in his afterword, about the only thing I could find him saying about this comic was, like, those Western editors were kind of a pain in the ass, but,
I had to draw it backwards, darn it.
Which actually, like, I'd love to hear. Yeah, he talks about sort of having to cater to Western taboos in a way that he wasn't used to, because this comic was commissioned by Nintendo Power. It was not a manga that was then brought over. Although I think that's interesting too, because I think for a lot of people of our age, this could well have been sort of their first exposure to something manga-esque, and certainly something by a great manga artist. But I think when you look at the art of this comic, you see a master who is working briskly.
Yes.
And that could be a bad thing, but I think it's a wonderful thing, because these sort of more sketchy drawings of the characters have so much energy and vitality. And
yes, they do.
Silliness, and the line work is just so expressive. And then the backgrounds are frequently stunning. Beautiful watercolor works that, you know, the action of this comic is so compressed. Everything happens very quickly. There's like a single page that's Link getting from the village to the Eastern Palace. It's three panels. I wish we could show this. Three panels of him traveling through a forest and along a cliffside and through a swamp.
That's right. That was a gorgeous spread.
Incredible. And it's so, there's no dilly-dallying. It gets so much done as far as world building in a way that, like, no number of lore dumps in later games, Zelda and otherwise, could ever match for me.
Ganon is in maybe a dozen panels, if that.
Yeah.
Like he emerges, he's dead, like, almost immediately.
Hello, and the there I go.
he like comes out, he's like, oh, you know, I got rumbled. And then he's just like, oh no, I can't move.
There goes my back.
But it's so impactful, just the image of him rising out of Aghanim's body, only to, like, the very next
the
page
light.
That enormous clash between he and Link. It's so striking. I said to Pete just last night, the thing that I remember thinking at the time, like, even as a little kid, is I wish there were no words, because you would get everything that this story has to tell you without them. Like,
that's true.
Even, oh man, like the haunting image of Link's dead parents being like, remember, we all did the work before you. Don't fucking forget it, you ungrateful lout. Like, it's fucking awesome.
Okay, Mom. All
yeah, right, but Dad. To your point, I mean, you've said this to me before, the comic almost works like a silent movie. It has the power of really great expressionist imagery, and it's just full of ambiance. And, you know, it has some dialogue, but the dialogue is not crucial to the experience, I would say. And I really cannot recommend it enough.
There was I've always had this belief, and I swear to God, I had information about it when I was a youngster, but I believe there is a very strong connection between Zelda and Legend, the movie by, of course, Scott Ridley. And I feel like everything's kind of getting twisted up in the canon here, but this is also a comic that gave Link a fairy guide, which was something that also happened in the movie Legend. So it's just like such an interesting little bump. And I think that maybe that became a bit of inspiration, kind of like how I'm just saying this, Link in our Western cartoons had a horse. He had a horse. Her name was Catherine. So who knows?
Yeah, I wondered about that too. I wondered about I just would love to know what notes Ishinomori got, because so much of what's in the comic, I mean, unfortunately, he died in the late 90s. So I think he drew too much.
That happens to some masters, unfortunately.
Yeah, but
it's really sad.
But it's looking back on it 30 years later and having played, for better or for worse, most of the Zelda games since then, I think it's startlingly prescient in a lot of ways. Mm. It seemed like they can't be coincidences. And one of the few things that I did manage to dig up was an interview with Miyamoto from the mid 80s, so before his reputation was really secured, where he talked about how big an influence Ishinomori had been on him.
Wow. Interesting.
Before they had contracted him to do this. So it seems like there were some elements of exchange and inspiration there.
That's really cool.
I want to make clear very quickly that Horny Fairy Guide for Link did precede all of this in the American cartoon that you got on Fridays during the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
How could I forget?
The horny fairy guide who's jealous of Link's romance with Zelda was a fixture already. So I'm sure
you're right.
Ishinomori was just like, I'm gonna leave all this other, I'm gonna leave the excuse me princess of it all over here. But I'm keeping actually,
now that I think of it, both of those go back to Peter Pan, at least to Disney's Peter Pan, and that's
absolutely
Tinkerbell and Wendy. It's straight out of that.
Pete, I don't know what you're talking about. The depictions of Tinkerbell in the Mary Martin play and in Disney's totally acceptable, reasoned, socially conscious film. There's nothing untoward about that at all. Actually, just a very brief aside about that. Having a 7-year-old, I have had to rewatch a lot of the classic Disney films the past few years.
Had to, like you weren't jumping on.
Had to, like being forced at a gunpoint. When you turn on the Peter Pan animated movie now, on Disney Plus, there's like it lingers on like for 30 seconds a statement that's like, "Yo, dogs, we don't, yo."
Where's Song of the South, Disney? Huh? Yeah. Where is Song
We're sorry
of the South?
About all of this.
Sorry about all of this.
It's just like sorry about Tinkerbell's dress. Sorry about everyone's dress.
Oh, are they sorry? Are they apologizing for Tinkerbell's? Because she gave us a boner, so we're worried it's going to give you a boner too.
It's they're really on the ball in a not metaphorical way.
I think that maybe they realize now everyone's a monster fucker, so they just like, no, hey, we all know you're horny for Tinkerbell. Keep it down, all right? Keep it down.
Link doesn't bat an eye.
Gallery.
No, Link doesn't bat an eye at all.
Link doesn't bat an eye. He is completely unfazed. I do find it strange that there isn't a cult of horniness that surrounds this comic, because Rome.
I was going to bring up Rome because I think it's actually very interesting. The thing with Rome is that, see, Link is a descendant of the Knights of Hyrule. That's always been kind of one of his things. And the Knights of Hyrule, the descendant of said knights, is supposed to have the power to wield the Master Sword. Now, here comes Rome and says, what? Did two people in the Knights of Hyrule fuck and that's it? I'm here too, man. I'm a descendant as well. And Link's like, oh, shit. So now Rome's like, I deserve to wield the Master Sword. And I think that's really interesting. I love the idea of there being a rival to Link. Because, like, no, you're not the hero. I am. That's a cool thing.
This guy who's sort of an anti-hero who appears in the Dark World, who's looking for Ganon himself. I think it's a great addition. And his fate and his sort of tragic flaw of his arrogance really fits in well with there are elements of this comic that are quite goofy and fun, but there is like a melancholia underlying a lot of it, and I think that character embodies a lot of that. And I think that the ending also, which Anthony
very sad.
Has written about, it's very bittersweet, and it really stuck with me over the years. Yeah. I mean, that made a huge impression on me as a kid, and it has to do with Link and Zelda, who have felt so close through this adventure, being sort of taken on different paths in life, let's say, which I thought, okay, maybe he just throws that in at the end. But actually rereading it this time, knowing that that was coming, I see a lot of that threaded through and anticipated. You know, there's a beautiful mix of emotional tones in this comic, from sort of the goofy to the spooky to the bittersweeter or melancholy.
Which that is vintage Zelda. Like, that is essential to that, like, at the time, the character of Zelda is, you know, to a lesser extent now. Like, I feel like when people respond very powerfully to Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, it is that balance between the flighty, the goofy, the sort of inconsequential.
Crucifying Koroks.
Crucifying Koroks. The sort of
watching.
Wan, melancholic feel of a lonely landscape.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I think about it, almost all my favorite work in any medium has the sort of sweet and sour qualities, you know, that Mother 3 is like, if you want to talk about another video game, a heartbreaker with like so many zany elements, you know, like a heartbreaker with a snake that you use as a hookshot.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hard line to walk, but the comic does it really well.
Yeah, if you think about, you know, you think about the Beatles, Day in the Life, it's like it has John Lennon's sort of existential ruminating parts, and it has McCartney, Wilco, got out of bed, you know, and it's greater than the sum of either of those parts, you know, that is what life is like. It's like this irreducible melange of sensations and feelings that you can't reconcile. And the best art contains all of that. And, you know, am I going to make a claim for this Zelda comic that was serialized in Nintendo Power as the best art? I don't know, but it hit me pretty hard this time. I really think it's totally worth revisiting for anybody who's curious about it.
I think all of these comics are definitely worth revisiting. Zelda and Link, the relationship there, I remember vividly, like even after rereading the comic, I still remember the scene, the last panel of her riding away from him, and he's just looking after her like, just that look on his face that says, oh shit, what did I just do? What have I gone through for what? And these days, the relationship between Link and Zelda is usually kind of, it depends from game to game, like Skyward Sword, they were obviously a couple and they were actually very cute. I think I like that couple the best. There's a scene in the really, really excellent Link Between Worlds where you find out that Zelda kind of looks longingly at this mural of the hero, quote unquote, and I guess her ancestor Zelda. So she has feelings there as well. They're sleeping in the same bed in Tears of the Kingdom, just like putting that out there. So
it's a classic will there, won't there? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, but
the Cheers of its time.
Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry. There's two play settings on the table. They're totally stripping, but that's fine. They should if they want. And this comic, though, it didn't work out. And until this point, Zelda had always been kind of a prize, like, yay, you rescued me. Or in two, you get a kiss, but it's obviously like, you know, what do we do with the ending? Oh, let's make them kiss. Yay, great, everyone go home. Three was...
No, in two, they're like, nobody's going to see it anyway. Nobody's... It doesn't matter.
Game genie pitch.
I saw it.
Damn Thunderbird. God, who makes that?
I saw everything.
Who says, I love children and makes a Thunderbird and like, go to hell. But I managed. I got the kiss and like they kind of put the curtains down. So it's kind of, oh, woo, woo, cute. But yeah, this was probably really one of the first mediums that gave Link and Zelda a really meaningful relationship, because even in three, she's like, oh, I'm in Sanctuary. Thank you. Bye. Whereas here, you do find out whether or not they ended up together. And it's a very clear, obvious no. And this is a trope that comes up from time to time when two powerful people are connected and then they drift apart. What are the people who do Illusion of Gaia, Quintet, they love that show. They are totally like just bawling for
it. I love them for it.
Oh, me too. Okay, Quintet, this comic's got podcast.
Big Quintet energy, big creation of heaven and earth energy in this
comic. We gotta talk about Soul Blazer sometime.
Oh, I got it. I'm recruiting you now for a Quintet podcast. I don't care. I want to talk Quintet so much. But for now, that goes over a lot of like the Zelda comic and the Star Fox comic. And why don't we talk just a little bit about the Mario comic? Because that's also kind of insane, but not as dramatic. more of a fun insane than a dramatic insane.
Where is more Charlie Nozawa art? Like,
yes, right. Excuse me.
The art in the Mario comic, like the Mario comic is like, it's one of those things that Zelda reads very well collected. Like you can read it as a singular work and it flows very well because it is so visual. But, you know, the Mario thing does have the feel of something that was, you know, sort of serialized in the classic, like, Uncle Bon magazine format. It is condensing a shit ton of visual and lingual jokes into a very small space. And it's just not pleasant all at once because it's so dense. But the art is so funny. And the whole thing, like, the vignettes are so fucking weird.
They are.
Like, when they go into the Boo ghost house and you get this like madcap depiction of Dr. Mario as behavioral therapist who's like, we're going to escape the Boos by doing talk therapy, and it's like six panels and every single one of them is goddamn hilarious.
it's so good. I actually love this one. I actually did read this all in one sitting because I was trying to catch up with you guys yesterday. It is very dense. I had no strong memories of this from when I was a kid, or I thought I did, but then I kept remembering little panels that are so funny. It's just, it like the art is fabulous. I have no particular fondness for Mario as like a milieu, you know? But I am so tickled by this comic. It's got like a great gag on every page. I was really like, I'm laughing out loud at this Mario comic for children. It's like, I mean, the one thing I did remember was psychotherapy on the Big Blue, which is incredible. But there's, you know, there's like little toads, there's like a strike team of commando toads that all have little mustaches and aviator glasses. And there's Bowser's kids are playing a version of Super Mario Brothers, but where it's Bowser kicking and punching a bunch of Marios. It's like
there's the scene I remember most. I don't even know why, but it's around the time they first meet the Yoshis and the Yoshi. And there's a scene where I can't even remember if it's Luigi or someone looking up and they see Yoshi's face taking up like the entire panel, like a fisheye lens, and then screaming. That was so great.
Yeah. It's just full of
huge
life.
Schnoz.
And I also have to say, I love the characterization of the princess.
Oh, she's great.
She's so funny, has so much like gusto. And really,
she was a maniac. Like, she was like, I'm not going quietly.
Exactly. I loved that.
And it's like, oh, now you're going to marry Bowser. No, I'm not. I'm going to dress as Luigi and get the hell out of here.
Yeah, hell no.
I don't know about you guys. Nadia, you and I talked about Super Mario RPG not that long ago.
That's right, this recording.
Like, there was such a strong link between these two things in my mind at the time. Even though they're, you know, separated by 4 years, which especially when you're a kid is an infinity.
Yeah.
But the like when I finally tried Super Mario RPG around like late 1997, I was like, oh, like clearly they referenced that comic because the vibe is so similar. Like that depiction of the princess is identical. The whole wedding sequence of like a big ridiculous weaponized cake that's fucking up Bowser. Like all of it feels so of a piece. And the bizarre like weird salesman that shows up to like
Floyd, the friendless salesman.
Yeah,
I think my husband refers to him all the time.
Grifting Mario and Luigi left and right, that also, like, he would just be right at home in Super Mario RPG as a character.
I have to take this moment to point out to our dear listeners of Retronauts, yes, Anthony and I did do this episode, Pantheon of the Blood God for Super Mario RPG. I just have to share the story where this is around the time I was on my school's BBS and we were playing Super Mario RPG and talking about it. It's like, you know, high schools across Ontario. Someone was so angry about that cake boss. They were just furious about the fact that we're fighting a cake. And this is after, you know, Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI, these big epic battles, fucking cake. And I'm like, well, it's Mario. It's fun. It's funny. No, why am I fighting a cake? He was really angry about the cake to this day. That's all I think
what
of.
What a dick.
Picked the wrong horse on buying that game.
He kind of did, yeah.
It is interesting how, so you guys are drawing these tonal connections, and it's interesting how a lot of times when we in the West got expanded media based on these games, it was way the fuck off. You know, if you look at the Super Mario Brothers Super Show, or the Zelda cartoon, Princess cartoon, or the Mario movie, or all that stuff was so clearly from a Western sensibility that it feels totally alien and bizarre in the context of later games. What's interesting about these comics is for how early they were, they're totally contiguous with the tone that would follow. You know, we talked about Majora's Mask and Twilight Princess and Super Mario RPG. And I think that, you know, having Japanese artists even under commission for a Western audience ended up with something that was much more in line with, you know, whatever the questions of authorial intent, but much more in line with what people like Shigeru Miyamoto had in mind.
There's also, you're absolutely right. And I'm also thinking of, there is like smaller comics to supplement this one comic where Wario would appear. And there was like fights, for example, over a Samus doll. And it's like, oh, I want to give it to the princess. I want to give it to the princess. And it's such a cute little doll. I actually used to use it as one of my very early icons for the internet. And I specifically remember the one where Mario is invited to Wario's house. And it's a trap. And Mario's having these great memories of, oh, we played together, me and Wario. We had a great time. And Wario's, from his perspective, Mario was a dick, like a huge dick. So there's a reckoning. And it's just, one of those comics where I think you're right earlier, Anthony, when you said it's meant to be taken in small doses. Because when you do, it's absolutely hilarious. But I guess if you go on for too long, it kind of loses that. On the other hand, I don't think there's a certain person. I don't think there's a single person on this universe who doesn't look at that picture of Princess Peach, like dressed up in overalls, and says, "I hope this doesn't awaken something in me." Because
I wasn't gonna say it.
It did at the time, and it has not diminished.
I don't think it has, because it came up a lot when people were talking about the princess's depiction in the movie. Like, why can't she have Luigi's overalls? And Luigi had a dress, and he really rocked it too. So good on Luigi. Yeah,
twice. Luigi wears the princess's dress, and then while Mario is playing psychotherapist, Luigi is playing nurse. I was like, there's something going on here. This is recurring.
This is recurring.
I still enjoy the Mario games that come out now.
Me too.
But the whole Mario franchise has become so sterile. And like, it's been pretty sterile for about 20 years now. Like, I am one of the few people that does not love Super Mario Galaxy, even. I know. Something's broken inside of me. But I miss there feeling like there was no rules.
Have you played Luigi's Mansion? Because that's where all of Nintendo's humor is going. It's hilarious.
I love Luigi's Mansion.
It's hilarious.
I love all three of those games. And
Mario is not the main center AAA focus is hilarious. Nintendo has some of the best writing in the industry. Nobody knows it. So that's why I'm so bummed that the Alpha Dream is out. I loved Mario and Luigi. I loved Paper Mario. I think the writing was brilliant. Sad.
I have a lot of hope for the future, because I don't think it seems like not enough people played it, but Bowser's Fury is its own
game. It was good. Yeah.
It's really, really good. And it feels a lot more lively and vibrant, and like they made a game that feels of a piece of this comic again.
Right.
Rather than like New Super Mario Brothers, which is like if a Walmart tag sale was given the reins of the Mario aesthetic.
Yeah, I wonder if it's just that there's too much at stake for them now, and they, you know, this is like their biggest moneymaker. But it's true that it feels like there's in the same way that Zelda after Link to the Past and Ocarina sort of became more formulaic, became more conservative. I feel that Mario has somehow become that over the last 20 years. And what it feels like, sort of, there's like a mandatory fun quality to it where you're like, oh, it's a fun zany universe. Yet I'm not really having that much fun with it. I found Odyssey kind of a slog, and it's odd because when I think about that game, I'm like, if you're thinking about like New Donk City, you're like, this is a game that is taking some big swings aesthetically. Like that's pretty weird. But it doesn't register. It feels all sort of plasticized and safe.
It's very flat.
It's very flat. If you read this comic, to your point, there's much more life in it.
One of my favorite headlines that I wrote for US Gamer RIP is, "There are no children in New Donk City." And I wrote this whole narrative about how, like, there are no children in New Donk City. Why? What has become of them? Like, I'll dig it up and show it to you guys later, because it was just one of those articles where I'm like, hey, it's Friday, I don't give a fuck anymore. Here's your 400 words. Pauline is apparently forbidding people from having children. Nadia, what's wrong with you?
There's a false ending in the middle of one of their bits.
That's right.
Ride off into the sunset. And then Mario's like, wait a second, this is idiotic. Why are we ending the story here? I want all Mario games to feel like this again.
Maybe they will. I mean, at the time of this recording, tomorrow is a Nintendo Direct. Who knows what you'll get?
A
tiny beat that I really love that I'll spoil is there's a big panel of Big Blue looming up behind Mario and Luigi, and the sound effect is loom.
I love, you don't see it that often. I have seen it a few times. Just loom as a sound effect is probably one of my favorite sound effects.
It's so good.
So I don't know if you guys went down the rabbit hole of looking up Charlie Nozawa, but this is like a Shiga Sato Itoi situation.
Oh, really?
He's like primarily a marketing guy.
Cool.
He made, you know, copy and ad illustrations and just happened to do things like this on the side. So it's not like you can like go find Charlie Nozawa manga out there for a similar experience.
It's really good for somebody who apparently never did it.
Well, that's better than finding out the Mega Man Zero artist was a hentai artist as well.
Who wasn't?
Were they really?
I don't know the full story, so I can't say it on here, but do some Googling. And you won't be surprised.
Exactly.
You think back about it.
I'm thinking about it. That checks out.
So,
not that I know.
Of course not. Oh, excuse me.
Oh, God.
Maybe this is a good place to end our very cursed episode. So, thank you all for listening. We hope you had a great time reading along with us. I think this was a great discussion. I want to bring you all back for a discussion about Valiant comics someday, if you ever read those.
Oh, the Game Boy comics.
Oh, that's like, a history right there. You want to talk about
Game
cursed.
Boy comics are weird as shit. Anyway, I digress.
Well, before we wrap up, let's talk about where we can be found. Peter, you go first, because you were the gentleman and Anthony and I were completely awful.
I've always liked you guys.
We like you too.
You can follow me on Twitter. It's Turbo McPhaser. We'll put that somewhere, I hope. Like I said, I work at Cuphead Maker Studio MDHR right now, but you can play my most recent solo game, which is called Witch Eye. It's about a witch who transforms into a flying eyeball of vengeance.
Cool.
Really meant to be like a very pure game experience kind of game where like you hit a snake and a gem comes out of it.
The good stuff.
And it goes bloop, bloop, bloop. And then lastly, if you like 80s metal or synth rock or the idea of a rock band from space, I put out a concept album last year called Star Patrol Return to Megatown. It's a really fun, bittersweet, emotional adventure with a bunch of cool guitar and space sound effects. So check it out.
Awesome. And Anthony, what about you?
Everybody play Witch Eye. It's got the best boss fights. I just want to put that out there. Those boss fights are really good. You can find me on the internet fitfully talking about how my first dream that I can recall was marrying Princess Lana in Captain N.
Well, Simon, Kevin was kind of really cute.
I went in a weird direction. You can follow me at A John Agnello on Twitter and Blue Sky. You can listen to my other podcasts, Continue Podcast and Video Game Grooves. Use Google.
Yeah, Google it. Where are you from? What are you doing? Yeah, Google it. As for me, I am your host, Nadia Oxford. I am Nadia Oxford at Twitter. I'm also on Blue Sky now, at Nadia Oxford. So I'm very easy to find. You can find more Retronauts at Retronauts.com or Patreon.com /Retronauts. $3 a week gets you early access to episodes ad-free and a week in advance. You can get exclusive episodes if you donate $5 a month, and you get Discord access for that as well. And then there's the Nintendo Ultra 64 level, which gives you the opportunity to choose a Retronauts topic once every 6 months. And you get all the other cool crap as well. As for me, you can support me over at the Axe of the Blood God podcast, where I co-host about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. Please visit us at bloodgodpod.com or patreon.com/bloodgodpod. Until next time, I'm young, I'm in love, and I have a spare bomb.